This is starting the recording for the ATR2 meeting with the board. The time is from 14:45 to 16:15, and this is July 14th.
Good afternoon, everybody. I feel conflicted. Yes, maybe so. Maybe I should leave. I'm a member of the, obviously a member of the board, and also a member of ATRT2. And So I was a little... Yeah, so it was suggested maybe since I'm conflicted I should step out. I like that solution, actually. This is our time to talk to you, and you can take that either way. But let me turn things over to Brian, actually. This is really time for the review team to talk to the board. And I'll apologize for having too many board duties, so I haven't been able to spend much time with the review team. My heart really is with both groups. Take it away, Brian.
Thanks, Steve. So, yikes. Hello. Is that better? That's better. Thank you very much, Steve, and to the board. Thanks for meeting with us. I just want to give you a little bit of an overview of where the ATRT2 is in the course of its work, frame up for you what the focus of our work is, and provide you with our timetable for our deliverables. And really the purpose of this exchange, as with our interaction with all the ACs and SOs this week, is for us to listen, frame up for you what we're doing, what we're focused on, but then sit back and listen, and we're really looking forward to your inputs. The ATRT2, as you know, is chartered under paragraph 9.1 of the Affirmation of Commitments. In terms of organizing our work, it falls into roughly these categories. We are undertaking an assessment of ICANN's implementation of the recommendations of the prior three review teams. So ATRT1, the Security, Stability, and Resiliency Review Team, and the Who Is Review Team. This review team will assess how well ICANN implemented the recommendations of each of those review teams. As this is an accountability and transparency review team, with respect to ATRT1, not only will we assess how the implementation went, but we may in fact generate follow-on recommendations with respect to accountability and transparency. Also, in our early discussions, we've opened up to, are there new issues that were not addressed by the prior review teams? And we have, in fact, addressed some new issues that we believe we need to assess, analyze, and determine whether or not a new recommendation on a new issue is warranted. So that's the organization of our work. The timetable for us right now is we will be meeting toward the end of August in Los Angeles. Well, let me step back. We are still in the data gathering phase of our work, taking public comments, taking inputs from the board, ACs, and SOs at this meeting. But in mid to late August, we will transition to beginning to draft recommendations in the report. We will be issuing proposed final recommendations in the mid-October timeframe. Those will be put out for public comment, and we will issue our report and recommendations to the board by December 31st of this year. One other piece of our work that you should be aware of before I open the floor for discussion is that we are engaging an independent expert, and we're in the middle of that process, who will focus on the PDP process in particular. We had some discussion and felt that that was an important piece of work, and as this review team is a collection of volunteers from the community, the benefit of having an independent expert provide an assessment analysis on an issue like the PDP made sense to us. We're pursuing that, and that'll be stood up shortly. So with that framing, we're really here. Oh, we've put some questions in front of you. Of the list of questions that are in front of you, the first six are questions that have come to the top of mind, if you will, for us in our discussions at this juncture of our work. The balance of the questions, seven and on, are questions that arose after we had reviewed public comment received to date. These really are questions that we've read comments and formulated either follow-on questions or questions that want to explore more deeply the comments that have been received. feel free to use any of these questions or to speak to any of these questions if you have views you want to share, but don't be constrained. This is an open exchange. We're looking forward to hearing your review, your inputs. And before we go, I just remember there's one more output of this group. Very important. We will be making recommendations on the review process itself. We're going to be assessing this process. There have been three prior review teams and making recommendations about the process and how it may be improved. So with that, I think I've captured anything at this point. I'd like to turn it back to you, Steve, and open up for discussion.
Yeah, 15 questions here. How much time do we have?
About an hour and 20 minutes at this point.
Yeah, so...
Don't be a slave to the questions.
Don't be a slave to the questions. I like that. Scanning these questions, which I've done before, and doing it again, I'm not sure I know where I'd like to begin. And I think I will punt and ask other board members if they want to comment on any of these or open up a discussion in some.
I have a question to the AT2. Are you seeking for board comments or for board members' comments? Thank you.
Thank you. This issue came up in our interaction with the GNSO. We don't assume that the board has formulated a board position on the questions that we put in front of you. We're listening to directors in their individual capacity. And again, this is looking for views. We have to take all of the inputs we get, review documentation, make a fact-based assessment on all of the inputs, but we'll take directors' views in their individual capacity to the extent you're willing to share.
I'll just pick a question at random because it's something that we've been spending quite a bit of time on lately, and that's the reconsideration process. So as you're probably aware, pretty much every new GTLD applicant that's been rejected has asked for a reconsideration. My comment on that, firstly, is that we actually undertook a pretty extensive external review of reconsideration processes after the last ATRT1 and had expert advice and implemented that advice. So our view was that it wasn't for us to say that, you know, we'd actually get the independent expert advice, and we went through a whole public process around that, and that's where the current system comes from. So that, just want to leave that as an opening remark. We haven't, as a board, tried to interfere in that at all. We've got expert advice, and that's where it's ended up. But having said that, the reconsideration process that we use in the bylaws is really... quite limited. It's basically looking to see did the staff or the board follow a policy or, you know, follow the process. And majority of cases, the staff or the board, depending on the question, is found to have followed the process. I suspect that's not really what people are asking for, though. They're actually asking for you to think again, which is not what that reconsideration process is designed to do. It's basically saying, we disagree with your opinion, have another go. And, you know, maybe we need to articulate that or have some mechanism for dealing with that. But it's almost like you're looking for a second opinion on the substance, which is not the same as what the bylaws do. And the terminology reconsideration isn't actually a reconsideration in the original opinion. So I just want to put the clarity there. I think that question in isolation is too isolated. It's really, what is the overall process when you disagree with an opinion and you want a second opinion, effectively an appeal, how should that be implemented?
Thanks, Bruce. Alan?
I think we worded the question incorrectly then. We are really looking at it in its widest possible scope of not should the reconsideration process be changed, although we've had some opinions already that indeed needs to be changed again even because of the last change. But we're looking at it at a wider scale of does there need to be a process of, let's not use reconsideration because we already have that one having a specific meaning, but a way to reevaluate decisions. And that's the question we're asking. What the answer will be, we'll see.
Uh, Sebastian had his hand up, and then Chris. I just want to insert. Oh, I'm sorry. I need help here. Somebody's got to keep track of. All right.
So hi, I have perhaps a question wrapped up in a comment, which is on number one. Isn't appointing an independent expert to assess the GNSO's policy development process effectiveness actually affected the review of the GNSO? And isn't that something that should be being done as a GNSO review rather than by the ATRT? I'm slightly concerned that you're asking, you seem to be suggesting that. I mean, I don't think you can review the policy development process without actually reviewing the GNSO, because that's an integral part of the GNSO. And that ties back down to question four, which is, do you believe that ICANN's organisation of advisory committees, and support organisations and their respective internal organisations are effective? And again, the internal organisations of SOs and ACs is a matter for them and the reviews that happen of them. So maybe I'm not supposed to ask questions, but I'm curious as to why you think that this is something that the ATRT should be doing rather than having it done in the review processes that already exist for those things.
Thanks for the question. The 9.1E in the affirmation of commitment says that the ATRT too should assess the policy development process to facilitate enhanced cross-community deliberations and effective and timely policy development. So there is an explicit element to address that in the charter of the AOC. The second question, if you could state
that again. It's kind of related, which is looking at the internal organizations, the effectiveness of the internal organizations of the SOs and the ACs. So maybe my point is that this goes to your review of reviews, I think, rather than actually criticizing the ATRT. It's like, so you're going to be doing this, and then there's a GNSO review, and then there's a CCNSO review to review the CCNSO, and so on. And it seems to me that what we have here is just constant reviewing in various different guises. And that's something that I would encourage you to look at very, very carefully when you're looking at the whole review system. I think I mentioned this the last time we spoke in Beijing, so we will review ourselves to death here unless we are very careful.
Thank you.
I need to rebuild the queue. Is Sebastian, you're next? Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to talk about the question two and the question three. So question two, because I think that the organization or the people who have no financial interest at stake, they are represented by very few in the board. There are the non-contracted house representative, or not representative, because you will tell me we don't represent, but elect by or select by, and the ELAC one. Then the question of the involvement, I will answer, it depends at which level of participation, level of producing policy or producing advice, and the level of participating to the final decision. And it's very different. I think I can do a good job in involving more and more participants from this type of stakeholders. And then the question could have been a little bit different and say how we can be done more effectively. It's not black and white. We are in a situation where there are good things going on, and of course we can always improve all that. And if I take back the review of at large, the proposal by the reviewer and to change the bylaw where it was different, that was the board adopted. It could be interesting for the ATRT too to come back to that and to see why and how it was done.
just to take the example, it's one board member or two board members from at large. The review say two, and the board decide one. And it's what was the rationale? It was long time ago, but what was the rationale, and is this rationale still alive? So second short point I wanted to make about the public comment is that we, as there is a board committee in charge of taking care of that. It was a public participation committee, and now it's a public stakeholder engagement committee that I have the honor to chair. We work hard on that. The problem we face was not that we didn't want to do what the AT&T one tell us, but we had limitation at the technology level. And we are still, we staff, struggling to find the best way, and I hope that what staff is doing now will allow us to implement something more open, with more ability to participate for everybody in the common period. Thank you.
Brian?
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me comment that in listening to some of the remarks so far, one of the issues that we've discussed at the outset, starting in our first face-to-face meeting in LA, looking back at implementation of prior recommendations, is this question of implementability. And implementability has a number of dimensions to it. Certainly, having participated in the first review team, with the benefit of a few years now, looking back at some of the recommendations, you see them in a different light. But that is a question that we are going to address, is the implementability of recommendations. We will endeavor to give an objective, clear assessment of how well the board and staff did, but also identify where implementation may have been particularly difficult for specific reasons. We don't want follow-on review teams like ourselves to be making recommendations that are very difficult to implement for one reason or another. So I just want to mention that this is something that will be a focus of our work as well.
Thank you. I have Shireen, Fadi, and Ray.
And then George. Thank you. I want to go back to question 14 about the reconsideration request. Personally, I'm very happy with the current process. But I do acknowledge that there is an issue there of people wanting to have a second opinion on the merit of the case. The way it's structured at the moment, it actually fits the role of the board, which is an oversight role, that the process has been done in a fair and equitable manner. What the board should not do is substitute itself in the place of the experts and become an expert board that gives opinion about subject matters. So there has to be an appeal process, but it's not an appeal that asks the board to become the expert. It has to go somewhere else for an appeal, so someone has a second opinion, and then it comes to the board. But the board should only look at an oversight of the process itself. And as it says at the moment, it says, has staff contradicted the policy? And has the board ignored material in making certain decisions? So it's a sword with two edges. If we open it up for something else, there'll be an avalanche of reconsideration endlessly, and the board will never be able to cope with it. So I am sympathetic to the issue, but I do like the process as it stands now, but there's something missing in the system that needs to be addressed.
Steve.
Brian.
I just want to emphasize, we have been hearing from different parts of the community, A, there should be substantive review of decisions, so, and you're reflecting that back to us. B, yes, there's a reconsideration process, but it's been used and no one's ever prevailed or had reconsideration go in their favor, so is that really working?
Perfectly.
Thank you. Get back to you.
I think that the key though is what you're saying is that you're looking for a substantive reevaluation of the decision, and that we don't have a process for that at the moment. I think that's the key.
And so we've been hearing this from different parts of the community, and it opens a question: is should there be a substantive appeal? ATRT1 carefully considered that question and deferred on it. Didn't think there should, walked through how could we build an appeals process on a substantive question. So there is a body of work there from ATRT 1. We're going to review again, but this is to confirm that we are hearing this for a number of parts of the community.
Thanks.
Yeah, Larry.
So this is Larry Strickling. I tend to agree with the formulation Shireen provided, which is that if all the board is supposed to do is confirm that there's a consensus, it should win every reconsideration because nothing should come before it that isn't presented to them as consensus. What I think the specific issue we heard today was, well, but what happens when you get into this situation where the board is being asked to do something that where the debate was, is this policy, is it implementation? There's no process by which that gets evaluated because that's emerging out of a staff work, and the community feels perhaps they didn't have a chance to provide opinion on that. And you then have the board agreeing with staff, this is implementation. You have the community saying, no, this is policy. How do you resolve that? And what's the recourse for that kind of decision? So I don't know if you want to, if Shireen or Bruce wants to comment on that more specifically.
So let me suggest that perhaps what if that's really what's driving this, then the idea of having a second opinion on the same set of facts or bringing new facts in or doing a reevaluation, if the main focus of that is because there's a disagreement about where the line is between policy and implementation, then perhaps that ought to be where the focus of attention is rather than the more general issue of should there be an appeals process, because if you do set up an appeals process, then you got a whole series of other things that you have to figure out. What is the basis for appeals, and how do you, you know, and what happens if that appeal isn't satisfactory, and on and on. All of which probably could be dealt with, but it may not actually be responsive to what's really driving all of this. I've inserted myself here. Quick response.
I'm particularly also referring, I agree with Larry's point, but I'm particularly referring, for example, we are going through a round of TLD applications. Some get rejected, and then the reconsideration request comes through, please, on the merit of the case. Now, we are not in a position to go against the experts who decided on the merit of the case, but what we can do is make sure that the expert have gone through the right process, that all the is being fair to the but we cannot just go against the expert in that case. So that was the point. But the implementation versus policy is another big issue which I think we need to address definitely.
Thank you. So I have Ram, Ray, George. Ram.
Thank you, Ram Mohan. I wanted to address two questions. First, question 8. Actually, a little bit of clarity would be helpful. I was trying to understand this, and the question says, has the community identified any specific issues that are outside of DNS in terms of SSR? Is that correct? Is that what you're asking? Okay, so if that's the case, here are my thoughts. Outside of DNS-specific issues, I've seen questions about global accessibility, about takedowns, but also about objectionable web content that is related to the DNS, but really is kind of in a different realm, if you will, and specifically outside of the remit of ICANN. The other area that I've also heard concerns about are about ICANN as an organization, whether the organization has an adequate plan or an adequate method to address enterprise risk. And that is outside of, that's specifically not just DNS, not just security, but really about enterprise risk across multiple dimensions. So I've heard that. Also heard about concerns about the effect and impact on end users and enterprises. But in that area, most of what I've heard still is related to the DNS and to the expansion of the namespace, things like that. So that's those are my thoughts on question 8. The second question that I wanted to address address is question three, which has to do with the public comment process. From my perspective, the mechanics of receiving comments seems to be working adequately. There is a process, there are dates, there are, you know, things like that. There is a public comment, there's a public announcement, things like that. But I have two concerns. One, my perception is that once comments are made, they often fall into a black hole. In other words, what happens to a comment once that comment is made is still, in my opinion, relatively opaque. I don't believe that those who make comments have clarity as to what happens to their comments and how those comments are specifically addressed by the board or the staff. I believe it would be more responsive to say explicitly to the commenter and to the community whether a judgment has been made that the comment that has come through has merit or does not have merit. But I don't think we go really all the way to doing that, and we could do that. Of course, if we go down that path, then that well-meaning idea falls prey to astroturfing. So there's a little bit of a balance that we have to find a way to get there. The second is whether the public comment process itself is sufficient. With many decisions, especially on controversial or sensitive topics, what I've observed is that the commenters seem to feel that they have to do more than just raise their comments. Board members get approached, addressed in various levels of robustness, shall we say, depending on the sensitivity of the topics. And that can be quite uncomfortable because we really cannot speak individually for the board unless the board has made a decision, and even then it falls to the chair or the CEO to speak on behalf of the organization. So I don't believe that we should move all comments only to a public comment mechanism in the electronic way that we do today. We should allow normal social interactions to occur, but it feels to me that we need a better system or methodology that brings accountability on both the commenters and the board and the staff.
Thank you. Ray?
Thank you, Steve. I have a number of things. Starting off with the second opinion. The first question is, what is the nature of the thing you're trying to get the second opinion of? And this goes to what Shireen was saying and what Larry has said. And this also gets echoed in question number 12. And it also goes to the role of the board and what is appropriate work for the board. Now, in the case of a policy, the board is adopting a policy. The consensus for the policy should have occurred within the policy forum of one of the three supporting organizations. It should be being presented to the board as this is the consensus of this community as to what should be policy. Please adopt it. And the board adopts it, but then by going through some oversight functions. It has to carefully look at it from the standpoint of its fiduciary and liability responsibilities. It also has to look at it from the standpoint, did that organization use its processes, were those processes transparent, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all oversight type activities. And lastly, it has a responsibility to examine it in terms of, is this really a policy that is appropriate for this organization? In other words, the board shouldn't be presented, I'll use a real gross example, with a policy that says we should paint that wall white. That's not within the charter of the organization. And if that's the case and you're wanting a second opinion of that, the only place that the second opinion can occur is to go back through the policy process. Now, if you're looking through the second opinion of something that that has been done by the executive with regards to the implementation of a policy, then the guy you should go talk to is the executive. And the executive should have mechanisms in place, and I believe he has or will have mechanisms in place to get the appropriate feedback to explore those things. And it's only when you really get to an issue of you're doing it wrong and no, I'm not doing it wrong, and it actually sometimes gets back to what is the interpretation of the policy. Again, if it's an interpretation of the policy is, for lack of a better term, broken, it needs to be fixed. And therefore, it's the policy process that does it. So, when you, and that's the spirit in which this whole reconsideration process was put together, was from an oversight thing. And yes, hopefully every reconsideration in that system is going to be denied because the processes were in place or were followed and so forth. Now, the ability to change the policy development process exists inside of each of the policy forums, and they should be able to make fixes there as well. So I would hope that when you're looking at the policy development process of the GNSO, for example, as you have to do under paragraph E, that you look at where are the appeal mechanisms inside that process as it moves forward. Because there should be, because there are going to be decision points along that path of that process, of that policy it moves forward. And therefore there should be reconsideration or appeal points along that as it goes forward. Because that is what is going to allow the stronger development of consensus policy. And the added bonus is that the earlier in that process that it happens, the less loud people have to yell about something. And so I think that I would invite you to put that into your criteria for the review of that. With regard to the question on review structure, in looking at the five things that are there that are supposed to be done, and also then looking at the other areas, who is and so forth, I think there needs to be something done that allows those reviews to kind of like be changed a little bit, or other subject matter being put in there. For example, there's one that's going to start now or soon would be the review of the impact of the first round of the GTLDs. Okay, well, I assume we're only going to do it once. I hope we're not going to do it every 3 years. You know? And, you know, at some point in time, we're going to review who is to death. I mean, does it make sense to review who is every 3 years? And does it make sense to review security and stability in that same manner? Is there not other mechanisms could do it? Now, I really like the existence of the structure to do this. And I think there needs to be an amalgamation of the reviews that are conducted by through the AOC, along with a different look that takes place inside the examination of the organizational processes, which is something would be done by ICANN itself. And also, the outputs from these things need to also go into the other review mechanism that exists that doesn't get exercised correctly, which is the strategic planning process. Because the front end of that process is always an examination of things like your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities, and your threats. And if that isn't another expression of a review, I don't know what is. And the amalgamation of those three things and the output from, for example, this review into the strategic planning process is important, because one thing that it will do is that you get it into the strategic planning process, it gets into an operational plan, it gets into a budget, and it is really implemented, and it really becomes institutionalized. Lastly, I'm looking at question number 10. I don't understand it. It says, does the community embrace decisions made in regards to IP addresses and AS numbers? I mean, are we supposed to go out and find a block of IP addresses and hug them? I don't understand that. Is there a criticism intended here about in embracing board decisions being embraced too? I don't know if I need to be embraced every time I vote on something. But the point is that what is really meant by this? acceptance of policies, okay, some people are going to be not going to accept it because the consensus was not in their favor, if you will. They'll never accept it, and they should continue to try and do things that can change it. Okay, if on the other hand the consensus went their way, I would assume they accepted it. I really would like to have an explanation of what is meant by this term embracing decisions. Thank you.
Good. The term embrace comes from the AOC, and that's something that in some way we have to find a way to measure that, and I'm not suggesting that's an easy thing to measure as a metric, not at all. What happened early in the stages of our deliberations as we began to frame out what should we be looking at, there were, from parts of the team, a strong sense that this is an important review. The last reviews did reviews that are focused on names, and that there had been no attention to numbers, that numbers is an important thing, aspect of what ICANN does, and that this question is born of the simple confluence of those discussions, that we have to, in some way, as a review team under the AOC, assess how ICANN's decisions are embraced by the community. Difficult task, I give you that, and that numbers is an important part of what ICANN does, if you will. It had not been treated in prior reviews. That's where it came from.
Okay, well, as a point of clarification, there has only been, I believe, 4 or 5, maybe somewhere in there, policy that have been adopted by the ICANN board with regards to numbers. There have been hundreds, if not somewhere over thousands, of policies that have been adopted in the various regions. And going across looking at the regions, you'll see that a lot of those policies are similar in nature, or they address similar problems, but they do it on a regional structure. And to a certain extent, they are global in nature, in that a globally recognized problem, if you will, is being solved on a regional matter without recourse to the ICANN board making it a global policy that is uniformly enforced across the board. So I'm wondering if where you're going to take this thing in terms of policies, because the policies that are acted on by the ICANN board really are policies that govern the way the IANA function is conducted with regards to the regional registries. So I would be interested, and I don't need to get into discussion today about that, with how the mechanics are, how you're really going to look at that. Thanks.
Thank you. So I'm going to read the whole queue here. George, Bruce, Judith, Erica, Bill, Bertrand, and Quo. If there's anybody I've left out, raise your hand again. And Larry. George?
Okay, thank you. I want to address question 7 because I think it's an important one. First, my impression is that there have been really substantive improvements in the way in which we've handled accountability and transparency. But that's not really the important thing to say. It's perfectly possible to have embraced, to use an AOC word, to have embraced the letter of a recommendation without necessarily embracing the spirit in the way in which it was presented, either consciously or unconsciously. But the more important thing is that the public comments, you note that public comments appear to indicate this concern. I have not read the public comments, but I would not expect them to be an unbiased source of opinion or evidence for this, because people who write public comments have something to complain about or something to say, whereas if you're really satisfied with the situation, you don't say anything. And I think the ratio in retail, which we're not, is 10 to 1, people who don't complain and people who do. So the question is, to what extent can your work identify concerns about lack of transparency and accountability, either new concerns or concerns looking at the level of accountability and transparency before ATRT1 relative to now? And I would argue that to the extent that you can base your analysis, your recommendations, your text on very specific instances and fact-based evidence, you will be able to help not only the organization in terms of increasing accountability and transparency, but in helping the board understand what the perceptions are of lack of those things that exist in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, just briefly, thanks for that, George. And we're reflecting back what we've heard, as I said in the last session, to the GNSO after one input. We have to make fact-based analysis here as a review team. So that's clearly understood. We have to be as independent and as objective as we can be as a collection of volunteers from the community, but fact-based is critical. So whenever we get inputs, we very often say, can you provide us some specific examples so we can assess that? Thank you.
Bruce, then Judith, then Erica.
Well, I'll talk at this time, like everyone else should ever get.
Judith.
Yes, I would like to address question number 12. Is it clear to you that the board has a dual role? The good news is the NOMCOM recognizes that the board has a dual role. We talk about the board as having two roles. There is the governance component, and there is, in the question, the last stop policy organ. I was brought into the board because of my corporate experience in a publicly traded corporation. And we are truly moving towards developing ICANN, the corporation, into a world-class organization that is capable of meeting the demands of the multi-stakeholder model. It takes operational skill and financial capability to deliver, and this consciousness was very much in the CEO selection committee, and the reason why, of all the candidates, it is Fadi. We are working towards it. Unfortunately, with all, there is so much that we are doing on the SO side of things that we are not able to share the gains of ICANN, the organization, the professional build-up that Fadi is doing. And I don't want to preempt him, but I can assure you we are conscious that we do have the dual role. You will be very proud of ICANN moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Erica?
Let me comment on something, primarily on question four. Do we believe that ICANN's organization of advisory committees and support organization and their respective internal organization effective in achieving ICANN's multi-stakeholder goals, and if not, how should things be changed? And then when I connected this in my little piece, which I did here on this paper, actually with 11, 12, and even 2, because I think what is interesting is the one feels the frustration behind the way the multi-stakeholder model works, how the policy process works, and I think part of it reflects some of the experience over the last months. I was wondering if maybe one should not add something which I, as a pretty newcomer still in this organization, feel sometimes what is missing, a piece. Because the way the process works and the way the forums works and the community works, it's although there's a lot of communication, it's more or less silo-oriented. So you have these communities which meet, which discuss, which have their own agendas. And then when the process all works well, at the end, it goes to the board, and then the board has to take a decision. Now, when the clash occurs, then the clash is more or less dealt between the GAC and between the board. And there is a bit in peace missing. So I wonder, even reading all these questions and the questions asked in this paper, if not one should think under certain conditions, specifically maybe to have some kind of quick ad hoc committees which come across the community and which try to not solve the problem, but narrow it down in operational and manageable terms, so that then it goes back to the community, but it's pretty much prepared in a way that the path is clearer how decision can be taken. Because I think the multi-stakeholder process, and I've worked in, as I said many times, in many international forums, I think it works pretty well. But this little piece, which I think it's somewhat missing, and that's why process become so long, because become very long or feel like suddenly, and I think that's something we should avoid, like astroturfing is evolving, because then communities or individuals or interest groups feel suddenly an issue is slipping away, and they don't know how to bring it back quickly enough to the existing processes. So maybe one has to look and introduce a method which works in this model, which evolved in the ICON history. So it's not foreign and not artificial, but still something which can close this gap.
Thank you. Bill and then Bertrand. And you want to respond? Go ahead.
Just a very quick response. The AOC uses the expression enhanced cross-community deliberation. We don't actually do an awful lot of that. If anyone has any ideas as to how we can actually make that work, please tell us.
Okay. Bill?
Thanks, Steve, and thanks for the opportunity to comment on these. I'd just like to very briefly support what Ray had to say about the reconsideration review and substantive reviews. I would really be cautious about that because it has the potential to move the board away from being an oversight board to a kind of adjudicator of disputes, as people would naturally tend to game the system, and you'd be in an endless circle of substantive reviews, so that's got to be handled really carefully. But the main thing I wanted to comment on is question five about the implementation of recommendations, and based largely on my having had the experience of co-chairing the board GAC recommendation implementation working group. And the main point there is that implementation needs to be understood quite broadly, I think. In trying to work with the GAC to implement the recommendations made to them the last time, the way they were phrased and initially treated was as though we would eventually get to an end state where we could say we'd implemented the recommendation. And that proved to be very difficult, partly because of working methods where it was very, very close to impossible to get work done between face-to-face meetings, a function of how the GAC tends to prefer working, and partly because we were feeling our way. There was a lot of comfort building went on in the early phases, and we're still, in with regard to a couple of the recommendations, working through a stepwise series of drafts and improvements. So we haven't, in fact, despite the fact we claim we have implemented all the recommendations, we haven't, in fact. What we've done is we've launched iterative processes that are really working. I'm satisfied with the results, but it was very difficult ticking the boxes, so to speak, which was what the reporting mechanism seemed to require. The similar topic with regard to the Who Is review. I've heard a fair bit of dissatisfaction expressed about whether the recommendations were implemented or ignored. And yet you look at the expert group on new directory services, which I think is quite clearly a case where the spirit of the discovery and the discussions that took place in the review was taken very much to heart, and the board has decided to look at going well beyond implementing the recommendations. So there again, I think looking too narrowly at the meaning of the word implementation could be a problem. Thanks.
If I may, thank you for that, Bill. A couple thoughts in response. In assessing the implementation of recommendations of prior review teams, those points are very well taken. A couple of the thoughts that we have in how we assess that are, number one, implementation of these recommendations should improve accountability and transparency in the organization in an organic way. And so that check-the-box results are informational but don't necessarily reflect improvements. And so that's an area that we're going to be looking for, is from what effect did the implementation of this recommendation have on the working, the processes, the cross-organizational functionality, ultimately the DNA of the employees. We're looking for that type of effect. I know that's a lot, but in response to your comments, that those points are very well taken. We can't look at implementation in too narrow of a way. Very aware that the review process, you know, speaking for myself at this point, hearing the let's not review to death and let's become effective in how we're using recommendations to improve accountability and transparency. But this time around, it's got to be more than just check the box. We have to see evidence that the culture of the organization is changing, that implementation is happening across the organization, involving groups of individuals. A test that's been articulated is if we walk through the halls of ICANN and tapped an employee on the shoulder and said, how does your job tie to accountability and transparency? What are you specifically doing to make sure that that's happening? There should be a response in most cases, or at least an understanding. That's what we're looking to gauge in this, and certainly make recommendations about how future reviews can be better shaped.
I want to drill down into this very last point. At the end of the ATRT1, I remember, I think pretty clearly, Larry pushing on the question, if we walk through the hall a year from now, and I think the formulation of the question was just slightly different from yours, would somebody be able to say what they're doing differently now than they were doing before? Your formulation is, would they be able to tie it to the accountability and transparency requirement? My reaction after, in response to Larry's was, I hate to tie things to a kind of transitional and passing phenomenon of a year later. Is it built deeply into the DNA so that it is just part of how things are done and not distinguishable that you're doing it because of an ATRT review? It's the way things are done. I have a feeling we're all trying to cover some aspect of the same thing, permanence and having it baked in there. And maybe as part of this review, you'll come back and visit that again and see if you want to tweak it or polish it and put the criteria in. I tried. There was a transition where before Fadi came, I tried to drive the implementation process, oversee it, and insisted that the last step in each of the recommendation implementation process, that there be defined steps for each of the recommendations, and that the last of those be the embedding of the change in the processes, in the manuals, in the training, so that it was absolutely part of what we do. I don't think we got there, but at least tried to make that part of the spec. So just speaking personally, I'd welcome visiting that, because I 100% agree with that. Q, Bertrand, Quo, Larry, Gonzalo, Shireen.
Thank you. Just, this is Bertrand Lachapelle. On question 12, the answer is clearly yes, we're aware that there is a dual role of the both as a governance structure and as a policy-related or substantive-related structure. What the consequences of this are and should be is still an open question, because it is a strange beast to have those two functions together. And the expression that is used here is the last stop on the policy trail. I would like to highlight that basically the way I view the board's function in that regard is a validation role in a sort of triptych, whereby you have the policy development on the one hand and the policy execution on the other hand, which is the executive function. And in both cases, either the end of the policy process or the end of a decision-making process in the execution may require validation at one point. It's the case, for instance, in the INF function, whereby it comes to the board, and in both cases, it is very much a process validation. The goal is to say, yes, the procedure has been followed, the consensus is achieved, and in the INF process, the process has been followed. But this is a role that can, however, extend in some cases when there is a tension or when there is something that is unresolved. and the decision has to be made because of external factors. So it is not only, it is mainly a validation layer, fundamentally, but it can go further. The second point is regarding question 14 and reconsideration. If you look at this triptych, and if you put in the middle all the consultation processes, the open forums and so on, which is the active information gathering part, the fourth leg, which is the redress system, the accountability system, is in my view largely underdimensioned, given the importance of the decisions that this organization is taking. I do not believe personally that the reconsideration process and the IRP are sufficient, in particular because they do not provide substantive redress for individuals or entities that have been potentially affected by a concrete decision. And I do not think that this should be the responsibility of the board, because the notion that there's a reconsideration process whereby the board is basically self-reviewing its own decision is wrong. It's wrong in terms of higher principles, because you're not supposed to be the appeal on your own decisions. And it's wrong also for the reasons that have been mentioned before, because if we are just validating that the process has been followed, then the reconsideration should not be about the decision of the board itself, but about the fact that the process was not followed, which is a very strange thing. And therefore, one of the challenges is when you look at the substantive redress, which is a fundamental principle of law, you either have recourse to the IRP, which is a very heavy procedure, very, very heavy procedure. It's almost a nuclear option. Or you go to national courts. And I do not believe that it is in the interest of ICANN as a system to force people to go to national courts to seek redress on its own decisions, because it then brings the whole accountability mechanism outside of the organization. And I think in that regard, the accountability mechanism regarding review of decisions, individual redress, needs to be addressed. I know it's a slippery slope. I know it's difficult. It certainly is not the responsibility of the board to do this, but developing this fourth leg is, I believe, an important element. Finally, on the issue of policy and implementation, we will have a whole discussion about this in the community. I would like really to introduce this notion that we discussed earlier of execution. There is not just a simple line between policy and implementation. Putting in place and managing the process of the applicants in the new GTLD program is fundamentally different from the exercise that represented the development of the applicant guidebook. The applicant guidebook was maybe the implementation framework. I don't know if it's what the appropriate word is, but there clearly was not, in my mind, a very clear-cut distinction between the decision that the GNSO had done in 2007, which was very high-level principles, and the whole development of the applicant guidebook, which involved a lot of consultations in the community. So it was not just a simple split where you had policy that involved consultations and PDPs, and then after 2007 and 2008, it suddenly became fully implementation, because it was not the case. It was a process that remained multi-stakeholder development. That being said, now that we are after the decision in Singapore, the actual execution of the program is something that really the responsibility of staff. But in between, when there is a tension, as I said, in the interaction with the GNSO Council, when there is a discrepancy between the evaluation of the GNSO, in that case, and the staff on whether something is policy or implementation, it cannot be the decision of one of the parties that solves the issue. It cannot be the staff, for instance, that says, we believe it's implementation, they believe it's policy, therefore it's implementation. It needs to go up to the board for decision, resending the issue to the GNSO. So I could talk also about the GAC involvement, but it's too long. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Bertrand Quo.
No,
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry.
No, I got.
nice try.
A second bite at the apple.
Yeah, we'll send it off for reconsideration. Quo, Larry, Gonzalo, Shireen, Ray, and then I want to close off and turn things over to Fadi for some material that needs to be shared here.
Okay. I'd like to comment about the question 10 and also the question 2. The first of all is actually Ray is asking about, you know, what's that mean. And I look at the question 10, actually what I'm thinking about is, first of all, actually for the IP address and the AS number, it's already have a process, we all know, from the regional and also in the ICANN, if we would remember, actually the ASO have a report in every ICANN meetings. And we also have a public forums, and even in the, you know, the WISIS or the IGF, you have a lot of place or process you can ask in about the IP number or AS number allocation stuff. So for the question 10, I really don't understand is those processes broken? Or those processes, they have questions? Because if you just read this statement, I don't see any reason you can tell me is that process have a problem or not. And what is the problem of the process is? If you cannot point out the problem of the process, current process, and to be honest, I don't see how we can answer these questions. You know, and I will recommend is we're going to, you know, get more detail about what is really the problem that you want to find out, you know, in the current process. I think it's regarding for the question 10. And back to the question 2, I really like to see that is I might be like to modify your questions. You see, those who do not have a financial interest, I like to take the financial off, because I think in the current ICANN process, we actually agree. Actually, it's open, right? If you have any interest in this process, you always can participate, and you can come to, you know, join in this community, even in the current address or AS number in the IR, it's open process. That means you don't necessarily have a financial interest. If you have an interest, you always can participate. So I think it's for the question two, I think it's more important is not just a financial interest. I think it's anybody have an interest in this ICANN process of the IR process. Do they have an effective way to present their view or their opinion or comment? I think that is a point. And if the people have no interest at all in the whole process, I think it's a very difficult you can go to grab those people without any interest. But if they have interest, we must make sure ICANN or IR or any, you know, we have the channel or process allow them to come in to make their question and to make their comment. So that is my comment for the question 2 and the question 10.
Thank you. Larry?
So I got on the list to make sure we talked about a topic that we haven't really addressed yet, because you folks are the only source of information we need on that, and that's question 5, and it really deals with the mechanics of you've now had 3 review team reports come to you.
Yep.
What have been the processes you followed? Is it now you think you have a standard process to deal with these reports when they come in, or did you handle them differently for different reasons? We need to understand that. And are there any changes you'd like to see, things that the teams could do to help the board in terms of how you actually handle these reports when they come to you? We've talked about implementability, so we don't need to cover that one again. But I know there's been an issue raised in the fact that since these teams disband once they turn their report in, is that an issue or a problem for the board? Would the board like to see the team kind of remain available for some level of consultation early on in the process as you take these recommendations and implement them?
Let me offer, I've given some thought to this set of questions. Certainly, as you said, implementability is one of the key things. One of the processes that we've tried to institute, that I've tried to institute, and it's been done by staff, is when we get a report, and it actually applies not only to AOC reports, but sort of broadly to, I'll call them expert opinion reports, is to subject the recommendations to the question of implementability. And implementability is both whether it's implementable, sort of the feasibility, and also the question of cost and time and resources and who would do it and so forth. And that, in my view, is an essential step prior to making a decision about which of the recommendations to accept and how to proceed past that point. So that's one thing which I think is consistent with what you've said, but I wanted to embellish it just a bit. There's another phenomenon which I've gotten sensitized to over the several years that I've been involved with ICANN, maybe it's time for me to rotate away and stop being sensitive about it, but I've watched expert groups, very earnest, solid people, and I know many of them separately over a long period of time, develop a sense of entitlement about they've thought about something, they've made a decision, they've made a recommendation, and therefore it must be so. And that has, in my view, speaking very personally, embodies two classes of errors that I've seen over time. One is a kind of groupthink of sort of setting on a course and arriving at possibly an imperfect decision because they convince themselves of a certain set of facts that may not be so, or looking at things in a certain way. And then the other is this entitlement of you asked us the question, and therefore we're telling you the answer, and now we own it, is kind of the mindset that I perceive oftentimes. And then they want to hold us accountable to why we didn't implement their recommendation. And that, in my mind, crosses a line and is a lack of discipline in the relationships, because ultimately the board in one respect, and ICANN as a whole, have the ultimate responsibility for the consequences of these implementations. So there's certainly an enormous bias in favor of accepting the recommendations. But I don't think it can be absolute, and I think it is a essential part of the process that there has to be a thoughtful acceptance and a sense of responsibility about that, and it should work reasonably well. If it goes astray in either direction, if we just wholesale reject things or wholesale accept things, things will go wrong. So that's my take on these things. In specifics, what you have seen is the ATRT-1, the basic answer, you quibble over details, but basically said yes to all the recommendations. With respect to the who is, something more subtle but qualitatively different happened there. We said yes to the recommendations. We said we understand the earnestness and the depth of the work that was done, but there was, in our opinion, to be quite straightforward about it, a flaw in the framework in the original AOC terminology that embedded that persisted the brokenness that was in who is. And so we said the way we're going to deal with that is we're going to say yes to this review team. We have to do that, and that is the right thing to do for the immediate and foreseeable future. And at the same time, we're going to finally rise to the challenge and kick off a strategic examination of who is. And we're going to do that on a distinct and separate track with separate resources, try to give it different terminology. And so that is a unexpected, perhaps, kind of response. And I would consider that to be an unusual, you know, not an ordinary kind of response, but nonetheless well within the scope of the proper dynamic. On the security, stability, resiliency, I think that is more of the normal. We accept the recommendations and we go ahead and. So I hope that's helpful to you in. It wanders a bit over it, but definitely a lot of fun. Anybody else want to? Brian?
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on one of your points on implementability, and I think what I heard you suggest, is, which would be perfectly appropriate in terms of process, is recommendations are received and the first filter they get put through is implementability. Are they? I think, speaking for myself, that an improvement on this process could be that there's an engagement between the review team and the board before the recommendations are issued, and that we have an understanding as a review team of what implementability challenges a proposed recommendation might trigger. And if we have that exchange before issued, then we're issuing recommendations that are more implementable.
I'll call in you, Mike, in just a second. I had forgotten to say and then remembered, as I turn things over to you, one of the key things about the SSR review is exactly what you've said. Those guys realized that it would be helpful to get a feasibility sanity check before they finished drafting their recommendations. And so in that process, they did exactly, they didn't engage the board, they engaged staff and got the right responses. And that that was a big help. You're pointing to David?
Yeah. That was David. Those guys were, it was David Conrad, yeah. To give credit where credit's due.
Mike and then Bruce on this.
Thanks. You know, I think some of what I'm hearing is what I understand is referred to as continuous improvement. Is we're now looking at iterative processes. I think that ATRT 1 saw some of the big changes, identified some of the main areas. I think that one suggestion to you is I think that the need for the second ATRT committee to actually delve into implementation issues and say you must do this is maybe not as great as there was with the first one. But I think that more time could be spent in identifying problems and suggesting approaches rather than specific practical steps which must be implemented. I think that would be incredibly useful for people to take a broad view, any number of terms, a helicopter view, call it what you will, but to take a slightly external view of what we're doing instead of while mired in the process and say, we're observing some issues. You need to take steps to affect this, maybe even some practical suggestions, but as been mentioned, we've had some situations where specific implementation has presented some challenges while the general principle has been accepted and understood, and we need to work around how to implement because we all understand what we're aiming at. I think that Fadi and his team have showed a commitment to continuous improvement, and part of it's at a staff level. I think some of it is understanding better how we can iterate these processes so that each time around there's more improvement. You know, I think to me one of the biggest disappointments has been the comment-reply-comment cycle. It has not had the desired impact. And what we need to do is instead of beating it and trying to do it again and again, is to say, this is what was intended, this is how we iterate to try and get to that desired effect. And Sebastian and others are trying to take that forward. But with the ATRT as it goes through, being a sanity check, being a big picture approach to this, not necessarily being an entity that needs to get down into the real detail of what and how, but rather which approaches are working, which aren't, where we need to put a bit more effort.
Yeah, I think Mike's put very much some of the concepts I was going to say. I think one of the things to do is perhaps in the way the reports are structured. I see a big difference between the way the ATRT 1 report was written versus the Who Is report. And you know, picking up on what Mike's saying, what's useful is to have sort of a clear requirement or recommendation and then have some implementation options for consideration. But there's always lots of different ways to solve a particular requirement. And I think we need to accept that we've got a professional staff and organisation. They will look at the different options and come up with a solution. So one of our struggles with the Who Is report is it kind of blended this high-level stuff with very specific. There'd be the equipment, using an analogy here, it'd be a bit like saying the requirement for this room, for this meeting, is to have a sound system where we can all clearly be heard. You know, that's the requirement. Now you might say one way of implementing that would be to put microphones on the desk and a speaker in the middle. But, you know, the speakers could be over there or up there. It doesn't really matter. And so I'd encourage when review teams are writing reports is really separate the core recommendation, which hopefully can be summarised in one or two sentences, from some options for implementation. But don't try and lock in the board or the staff particularly into that. And the GNSO policy on new GTLD is very clearly identified, actually. There's a separate section. One section is the recommendations, which are generally one-sentence recommendations. There's another section of the new GTLD policy report, which is implementation guidelines. And in many cases, the staff have actually used those implementation guidelines, but in some cases, they've used a different implementation. So you just need to separate the requirement, the high-level recommendation, from some guidelines for implementation, but not try and lock the board or particularly the staff into a particular implementation.
Thank you. Gonzalo?
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with Bruce and Mike over this issue. I think we need to find some principles and then how to see how we can implement it. In that regard, I have a brief comment about questions 2 and 3. If, as I read them, I cannot see a clear differentiation on the purpose of the questions. Both of them are pointing to participation. And as I read question 3 or 2, it's subsumed in question 3. So perhaps it's just my reading, but I think it could be more interesting to know exactly what is the difference in the participation that you are pointing out in question 3, and how can you differentiate it from the process to participate, which is implied in question 3. So that's basically my comment. Sorry. One more thing. I think it's redundant that phrase to including those who don't have financial interest at stake. As Corway pointed out before, this is a process where it's meant to be open to everyone with the interest to participate. So I don't see why it's the reason to have that kind of differentiation in that question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shireen, Ray, and then we'll turn the floor over to Fadi.
I'd like to go back to question.
You wanted to respond to
Alan, do you want to respond?
Yeah, sorry.
Two things. Yes, the two are somewhat related, but number 3 was specifically talking about the public comment process and was not and was saying, does it work and is it listened to? And so that was really focused. Number 2 is, yes, we understand that anyone can participate, but the question was asking is, do we really get substantive involvement from those without financial investment? In other words, we know a registry and a registrar are going to participate in a policy discussion that involve them. Will we get involvement from people who may be impacted by the results but have no financial stake, have no financial backing for the time, the travel, or whatever else? And that's really the question it was asking there. So a different question, not are they allowed to be involved, but does it really work?
Cool.
Aaron, basically, from my understanding, well, they say this way, until we really, we understand that internet is very important to almost every person on the earth. So how you can sacrifice, say, here is a financial interest, and here is a no financial interest, cut a line and say he can come in and he could not. So I think in general, no matter the progress, we can talk about how we can make the progress more effectively, but we cannot say you have no financial interest, you cannot join in.
But let's follow it offline.
Okay. Yeah. Let me move on here. I'm watching the Shireen.
I'd like to make two brief comments, one on question 12 and the other one on question 7. On question 12, it seems to imply that the board has a dual role, and I'd like to really kill this notion. And the reason I want to kill this notion is, as Ray said earlier, we don't have a role in governance and a role in policy. That is wrong. We only have a role in governance, and part of that is an oversight of the policy process. The board doesn't have a policy role. We do not create policy. All we do is adopt or not adopt a consensus policy that's come to us. So it would be very, in my view, very dangerous to start giving the board a dual role of a policy and a governance role. And so that's one point on number 12. On number 7, I want to reiterate the points that George has made on transparency. At the time of ATRT1, the board did not publish a rationale for its decision and resolution. Now, diligently, it published its rationale, and diligently, it published its resolution 48 hours after the resolution has been taken. Also, all the minutes are published. So I do not know, in my personal view, there's been a substantial improvement in transparency and accountability. So I do not know where the comment is coming from. Maybe the quality of the rationale is not as good as people want it to be. Maybe the minutes are published a little bit later than they should be. But I think there has been a substantial improvement. So we'd like to know specifically what is meant by these comments. Thank you.
Sebastian, you've been raising your hand. You want to respond on these points? Okay.
Sorry, both Sharon and Ray, but I didn't know that vertical integration was an implementation decision. When you say we didn't do policy, it's not true. The past shows that the board have to do some decision policy because we are the only body where we can get the inputs from all the stakeholders at once.
Oh.
And that's the place where sometime we have to take some policy decision.
All right. Chris, and then we'll pop up on this and we'll finish with Ray.
I just wanted to say that the conversation that's just taken place between Sebastian and Shireen illustrates the problem. Some people think it's policy, some people think it's implementation. Whichever side of the fence you happen to be on, you can say whichever suits you best.
Yeah.
Sebastian is adamant that it was policy, and you know others are adamant that it was implementation. This is the crux of the problem.
Ray?
Thank you, Steve. First of all, first question I want to deal with was question 12, and I want to join Shireen with really taking the wooden stake and pounding it hard through this notion. The board has got one role, it's of governance. When the board goes upon itself to make a policy, the board is wrong. In the case that Sebastian describes, where the board did make a policy, it's clear to me that the next step of the board would have been to send this thing back to the GNSO and say, we need a policy. And we didn't do that. So, Shireen, you can get the biggest hammer, I'll get the biggest wooden stake, and that's it. With regards to accountability and appeal mechanisms, the board is ultimately accountable to the community, period. And
thank you.
Various organs of the community put members of the board on the board. So we are accountable. We have to make sure that any outside appeal mechanism that we engage is something that's going to do two things. One, enhance that accountability to the community, and the second thing is to enhance the process for which that appeal process is being attached to. And so the board in an oversight role actually acts as an appeal authority. Yes. To a certain extent on certain matters. But on the other hand,
let me break in here with an implementation detail, which is that we're out
okay,
of time.
I will stop on that one, and I want to touch briefly on five.
Well, I actually want to...
Well, I was going to give you a plus one, Steve, so forget it.
Thank you. I want to shift. Fadi wants to share some information with the review team that is important to share.
My apologies, but I'm late to another meeting, so I'll just be brief if I could. I didn't want some of this information to just be shared tomorrow with the public without having had a moment to share it with you. First, you've seen the announcements in the last few weeks that we have created a separate unit within ICANN called the Generic Domains Unit. This is a very, very important change in the way we are structured. It resulted from us being accused of being a bit Janus-faced, because on one side of ICANN, everything has to be bottom-up, slow, multi-stakeholder, to the T, more of a marathon rather than a sprint. And on the other side of ICANN, which is the side where we're managing our contracted parties and we need to implement things, people expect us to be efficient and to get the job done, and when a contracted party does not perform, to actually stand up and say, you're not performing. And so one CEO of a CCTLD wrote a blog saying, you're Janus-faced. Of course, I met him immediately and spent quite a bit of time with him, and actually turned out to be very, very helpful. As a result, we are splitting the Janus phase within ICANN, and we will now have a division. Akram Atallah was promoted to head this group. This will be the group responsible for managing our contracted parties. This will be the group that will focus its activities on ensuring that the registrants, who are the ultimate user they're responsible for, are receiving the value and the service they should be receiving from the licensees that are getting licenses from us to operate certain GTLDs, and the registrars who are accredited by us to perform these. That's a change in our posture, and it's very important. And it will strengthen our compliance regime, which will remain reporting to me, and will have a way up to the audit committee, if it needs to, independent of me. So we're putting some things in place that, frankly, are learnings that will improve immensely the posture and the quality of the work we do on one side, and give me the oxygen and the focus on the other side to continue nurturing and supporting the multi-stakeholder process that is so vital to our ability to tell the world, you can come to ICANN, and it is a multi-stakeholder transnational organization that knows how it gets its work done. So this is one important thing I wanted to share with you. The second thing I wanted to share with you is that clearly you know that ICANN is now engaged in a strategic planning process. This is very critical, because we have not taken that step back in depth as a community and done that now for a while. So the process started in Beijing. The conversation is ongoing. We are going to deepen the conversation again here in Durban. And there's a whole set of processes that are in place to inform that process. That process will end at the end of this year and will result in a strategic plan that, just for form, will not exceed 5 pages. So this is a high-level strategic plan, not an operating plan. On the heels of that, we plan to build a 3-year operating plan, which will then inform our yearly budgeting and planning processes. Normal operating procedure happens in any organization. That's where we're going towards. Now, what I will announce tomorrow is, as we are getting feedback since Beijing on the strategic plan, there are four or five areas that we're feeling are nutty or complex enough that we need to strengthen the process of getting input about these areas by building some adjacent process or informing process to the strategic planning process. We looked at the past of ICANN. It turns out that ICANN in the past needed things like that, and they used a vehicle called the President's Strategy Committee. I don't like the name, but it's a name that was used before. It's a process that was used before. I'd much rather call these a community strategy group or committee, but we're going to stick with at least the model that existed. We will have five of these shared and announced with the community tomorrow. The first one will focus on public responsibility in order for us to create a true framework of what is the public responsibility framework that ICANN community should work in to ensure we don't go out of our remit or we don't argue what is our public responsibilities. We should have a framework for that. Nee Quaynor will chair that committee. Second, we're going to have a committee that will focus on the role of ICANN in the Internet organization ecosystem. And that is the ecosystem that includes ISOC, IETF, the RIRs, the TLD, regional TLDs, etc. All these organizations that exist today to serve the Internet, what we sometimes refer to as the ISTAR system. What is exactly the evolving role of ICANN in that system? Vint Cerf has agreed to chair that committee. Third committee, we're going to have a committee that defines the technology roadmap of ICANN and becomes a bridge to all the technical communities, especially the IETF. ICANN has lacked a true CTO function, frankly, almost since Postel. We do not think we need to hire a CTO because a CTO means that ICANN is making technical decisions, technology decisions. That's not for ICANN staff to do. This is a community framework. And so we want to create a committee that starts looking at these things and builds bridges to the other community and starts answering things like, what is the future of the DNS from a technological standpoint? And so, again, to lead a committee like that, we wanted someone who the community will appreciate. And so we went to the inventor of the DNS. So Paul Mokepetris will be leading this committee. The fourth committee is a committee that you should, frankly, be pleased with. I hope you will be pleased with all of them, but this one is particularly important to what you do. We believe that it is time for us to step away from everything going on and how we make process policy and how we're structured to make policy, and to look at it from the outside in and say, is this working and how will it scale as we grow? So when we embrace the world and bring the world to ICANN and people are starting to come to ICANN, are we really prepared to engage them in our structures and our policy-making processes effectively? So we're going to look at this committee, which is going to be called the Multi-Stakeholder Innovation Committee, to think out of the box about how we can evolve this model. This committee will be led by Professor Beth Simone Novak. Beth Simone Novak was the deputy CTO of the White House. She's an advisor to Cameron. She's the head of the governance lab, the most important lab in the world now that is looking at how to evolve governance. And I think we should be very pleased because she had six projects as options to focus on. MacArthur and the Knight Foundations are funding her with many universities. And she picked ICANN because she felt ICANN is probably one of the most fascinating and interesting models of transnational governance and consensus-built governance, and she wanted to help us reinvent that together with the community. Again, these will all be community-led, but we just needed people to lead these committees. And the last committee is one that will focus on our place in the Internet governance ecosystem. And so this is not just the organizations such as ISOC and our colleagues in that space. This is about how we deal with governments, how we deal with international government organizations, what is our place. I frankly am tired of being defensive. I'm tired of going to defend us in various fora. It is time for us to frame our model and go and tell the world what a great model we have. And it is indeed a great model. There are very, very few models that work like ours today. This particular committee is the only one I can't share yet with you who will share it. We are talking to multiple potential chairs. It will be a very high-level committee. It will be multi-stakeholder, even though it's focused on governance. It will be multi-stakeholder. And we're looking at people like the last CEO of Citigroup and people of very senior level that will come in and actually bring various views into how we should evolve our governance place in the world. So this, I just wanted to share these with you because they're substantive. These committees, again, will be dissolved in a year. They will have less than seven people. They will be fully transparent. No board members or staff members will sit on them. So these are very, very open and very community-oriented groups that will then inform the strategic planning process. The outcome of these groups is not coming to me. It's coming to all of us. That's why I didn't like the name presidents. This is for all of us to take that input, and then maybe we'll translate it into recommendations, maybe we'll translate it into policy, maybe we'll translate it into something else, but it won't be imposed on our community. Okay? So this is my sharing of an update with you. I do have some other things I wanted to share, but we ran out of time. I do have a solution for how we avoid recommendations going into kind of... I'm not going to use the word oblivion, but into some place and staff, and it's a black box, and then we have to do a review to figure out what happened. There is a way to solve that. Other organizations have solved it. Bell Labs, after 50 years of building massive technologies and so on and so forth, figured that out. There are very specific groups called systems engineering that solve this issue between implementers and people who come up with specs. We need to address this head on, and there are ways to do that. This is not very difficult. We're just missing, as you've said, Alan, before, we're missing something in the middle. And as also Bertrand said, we'll come back to that. And my question that I wanted to ask you, you asked us 15, so I wanted to ask one. You know, my son plays the piano, and I always tell him, you've got to play better. You've got to get better. And he says, Dad, against what standard do I need to get better? I said, well, our neighbor's son. You know, look at Chris, how he plays. He gets up at 5 a.m. to play the piano. You don't get up at 5 a.m. I feel like we are constantly pushing ourselves to be more transparent and to be more accountable. What is the standard? Who are we comparing ourselves to? Because I don't see anybody who's much better than us. Okay, so maybe we should at least get to, okay, we're doing good. And what is the standard we're going after? Because it's not clear to me. It just seems like we did what we can, but now we need to do more. Well, do we need to do more? And what is the standard we need to live against? I think it would be fantastic if you could help us with that. If you could tell us, look, this is the standard of transparency. This is someone you can look to, and you have a long way to go to get better than them. But if we can't find anybody who's better than us in transparency, then maybe we should stop beating ourselves too hard. Thank you. I have to run. Yeah. So.
Thank you, Fadi. Brian?
Yeah. No, thank you very much for that, Fadi. Much appreciated. I think we're getting close on our time because we have an interaction with the GAC as well, so I think this is the right time to close unless there's something else. Thank you all very much for your thoughts. We'll be coming back to you before our process is over. Thank you very, very much.